I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in from Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. COVID-19 is once again spiking across the country. In the past 2 weeks, there has been a nearly 20% increase in COVID-related hospitalizations. But we're not in 2020, or even summer of 2021. While cases have risen, so have vaccinations. About 67% of all Americans are fully vaccinated. But now we are hearing words like immunity defiant associated with this latest variant. So with all of that information, how should we be responding to COVID-19 now? What are the goals, and how should we be trying to achieve them? With us now is someone tasked with answering those questions at the federal level. Dr. Ashish Jha is White House COVID-19 Response Team Coordinator, and he joins us from Washington. Dr. Jha, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Kimberly.
So what is your current assessment of the rise in case numbers we've seen, as well as the rise in hospitalization?
Yeah, so what we're seeing right now is this subvariant of Omicron, a version of Omicron that we saw over the winter called BA5. And we've been tracking it since April, and it is now the majority of U.S. cases. So what do we know about BA5? Well, first, there is the increased potential for reinfection. So if you were infected 3, 4, 5 months ago, your protection against reinfection is very, very low. If you've not been vaccinated recently, if you got vaccinated last year, you can have a high risk of breakthrough. But here is the bottom line that people need to know, which is the things that we know that have been working for us as a country, keeping up to date on vaccinations, using treatments, using the tests that we have, they all work for BA5. Like, our tools continue to work, and if we use them effectively, we can continue to minimize the impact on serious illness and death.
So when you're talking about the tools and saying that they work against BA5, what specifically are you talking about?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Right? First of all, the rapid antigen tests that we use at home, they work just fine against BA5. So there have been some questions of, do our tests work? The answer is yes. Second is treatments. I think at this point, anybody who has any elevated risk of a bad outcome, somebody who's older or somebody with chronic disease, if they get an infection right now, they should absolutely consider getting treated. And our treatments work great against BA5. And then the last but certainly not least, and arguably the most important tool we have, vaccines. You know, we are seeing more breakthrough infections, but the bottom line is, even with BA5, if you've been recently vaccinated and boosted, your risk of ending up in the hospital or dying is dramatically, dramatically lower. So vaccines continue to protect against serious illness, despite the fact that BA5 is more immune evasive.
So I want to talk a little bit more about vaccines and boosters in a moment. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about BA5 itself, which I think is one reason why there has been some confusion, including on speaking for myself on my own part. We are seeing that it is very infectious, that it can reinfect people who have previously had the virus. Even people who have had it very recently are getting it again. So help us understand the disparity. We have this very transmissible variant, but you're saying the tools are working.
Yeah. So first of all, we should take a step back and think about what's going on here. What's going on is, over the last year and a half, we have built up a wall of immunity in our country, largely through vaccinations and boosting, but also through prior infections. And that puts pressure on the virus, evolutionary pressure on the virus, to try to figure out how to evade our immune wall. And that's what's happening. So we're seeing every 2 to 3 months more and more immune evasive variants. And this evolutionary process is not going to stop anytime soon. I mean, it's going to continue for a while. Our job is to try to keep up with the virus, which I think we're doing in many ways. We're going to have new boosters in the fall that are Omicron specific. But also, when I say things are working, what I mean is, look, the number one goal is we got to keep people out of the hospital. We got to prevent people from dying. And both being up to date on vaccines, having gotten a booster shot this year. For instance, I think everybody in America who's 50 years of age and above, if they have not gotten a shot in the year 2022, they need to go out and get one now. If people do that, if people get treatments, we can keep people out of the hospital. We can keep people from getting very, very sick. And that is what I mean when I say our tools are working.
And when it comes to boosters, Are they really necessary for everyone? Some experts say, you know, we really need to focus on the most vulnerable getting the boosters. They're perhaps not as effective in healthy people in guarding against BA5. What do you say to that?
Yeah, what I say is, you know, in medicine, we know that vulnerable people always benefit most. I mean, so obviously, somebody who's vulnerable, 85 years old, has multiple chronic diseases, we need to do everything we can to get those people boosters. But that doesn't take away from the fact that a 45 or a 50-year-old also benefits. Benefits always accrue most to the most vulnerable. But, you know, right now we have plenty of vaccines for everybody. And our effort is, of course, we're making extra efforts to try to reach vulnerable people. But for people who are young and healthy, if they have not gotten that third shot, it is absolutely critical. This is a vaccine that requires three shots in my mind. And it is absolutely critical that they get it. And the other question that comes up a lot, Kimberly, is people say, well, if I get a shot now, will I still be eligible for a Nomicron-specific booster later in the fall or winter? And the answer is yes. Getting a vaccine shot now protects you for the rest of this summer into the fall and does not preclude you from getting another booster later in the year.
So I want to talk a bit about the role politics has played in the response. Critics have said that the CDC has been sidelined in the Biden administration. Some even say that it's been held captive by the White House. What is your response to that?
I don't mean to laugh. I don't understand what that exactly means. I mean, look, the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, your audience will know her well. She is from Boston, one of the leading infectious disease experts in the country, arguably the world. She has been leading the CDC response. Every public and private event we have, CDC is at the forefront. They have been driving policy really across since day one of this administration. The president made a commitment, and I think we've seen it with Dr. Walensky out there, that we would be driven by the science and we'd be driven by evidence. And so I understand why there were concerns about CDC independence and scientific integrity during the Trump administration. I think under this administration, we have seen CDC at the forefront of these decisions, and that's appropriate. That's what it should be.
Well, what about the fact that after all of the legal fights over masking requirements, for example, that ultimately fell most notably with the transportation mandate falling, so now we see lots of unmasked people on planes, for example, yep, that there is not the same push to say, hey, people should be masking, particularly when we see these variants. Is that an example of the politics of the pandemic getting in the way with the federal response?
Yeah, so let's talk about this kind of very plainly here. On the issue of federal mandates for masking on public transportation, the CDC had that mandate in place, and it was a federal judge that struck it down. And the administration's response was to appeal that decision. We thought that was the wrong decision, both on the legal substance, which I'm not an expert in, but certainly on the public health substance, on which we all agree that was a mistake by the federal judge, and that is under appeal. You know, we're a nation of laws. We're going to follow the laws, and we're going to carry this all the way through. So when people say, well, why doesn't the federal government impose this? My response is a federal judge struck it down, and we're going through the courts on that. In terms of messaging, you know, I have been very clear, and Dr. Walensky has been very clear, that in areas of high transmission, wearing a high-quality mask indoors, especially when spaces are crowded and ventilation is poor, prevents you from getting infected, reduces transmission. We've been unequivocal on that. And so, you know, it's interesting, Kimberly, because at this point in the pandemic, I think we know what the science is. We know what the evidence is. There are people who try to create confusion around those things, but we are very clear. And I feel like our job in the White House and the CDC is to communicate very, very clearly. And on masks, I think we've been as clear as we can be.
So I recently have heard from a lot of people who have said, particularly immunocompromised people, have said they really feel like they've been left out on their own with this guidance, particularly when it comes to things like masks. I mean, I'll speak personally. I was on a plane yesterday. I have asthma. I wore a mask. I was the only person in my eye shot wearing a mask on that plane. Does that give a sense to the public that the CDC and the folks in charge of the federal response have forgotten about them, that they're not focused on them?
Well, I would say a couple of things. first is I flew down yesterday from Boston to D.C. and I wore a mask on the plane. And I actually happened to be on the plane with Dr. Walensky, who was also wearing a mask. So my point isn't the individual mask wearing, but it is I wear one. I think when you have high levels of transmission, it's a good idea. And we've been very clear on the messaging. In terms of policy, I'd already described that the federal mask mandate was struck down by a judge, and we've appealed it, and it is in the courts. Let's talk about immunocompromised individuals, because we need to always be thinking about our most vulnerable and what we can do to protect them. There, I think there are several things. I mean, first is there is a drug called Evusheld. Evusheld, so one of the reasons why immunocompromised people need extra attention is because often vaccines don't work for them. So the administration has put a lot of work in to make sure we have adequate doses of Evusheld available for free, and every immunocompromised American in the U.S. should be getting Evusheld. It provides a very high degree of protection against infection. Second is we've done a lot of work to make sure that high-quality masks are widely available and free. Third is the messaging around the importance of keeping infections down, the value of wearing masks. And, you know, look, I think the last point is I'm always up for other ideas. If there are other things we should be doing to protect vulnerable Americans, we're game to hear it. I'm game to hear it. For me, the most important thing is we're focused on making sure that the things they need to protect themselves, and then obviously if they get an infection, making sure that high-quality treatments are readily available. That's our strategy, and I think it is very focused on making sure we're protecting people who are vulnerable.
All right. Dr. Ashish Jha is White House COVID-19 Response Team Coordinator. Dr. Jha, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
When we come back, we'll talk to two experts about the response Dr. Jha just described and what we can expect the virus to do next and how we should be managing our toolbox to keep people healthy. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the BA5 COVID-19 variant, what data to look at to understand infection levels throughout the country, and what good virus management looks like at this stage in the pandemic. Joining us this hour from Pittsburgh is Dr. Amish Adalja. He is senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Adalja, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Marlene Wolf, who is with us today as well. She is an environmental microbiologist, engineer, and epidemiologist, and assistant professor in the Gangrosa Department of Environmental Health at Emory University. Dr. Wolf, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
So first, I want to get both of your reactions to what Dr. Jha just said. When it comes to how the CDC has been managing this virus, Dr. Adalja, what do you think? What grade would you give it?
It depends upon what aspect of the CDC response you're talking about. But I think it's telling that we hear more from the White House than the CDC director about these things. And I think that speaks to this being managed as a political problem. And that depends upon – it doesn't matter what side of this you're on. If you're on the right or the left, it's still being managed more as a political problem than a public health problem. And that's the worry that I have, that we're seeing the CDC be something that is used by the White House of either party to be part of their domestic agenda rather than stand alone the way maybe the Federal Reserve stands alone. And that's what I worry about. But it's definitely true that what Dr. Jha said, that we are in a different place in 2022 with – rapid tests with Evusheld, with other monoclonal antibodies, with antivirals, with vaccines, with boosters, with an updated vaccine, that we are managing it in a way that you would other respiratory viruses, and that's where this is going to go. But I would like to see the CDC be something that kind of returns to the way it was during Ebola or the way it was during the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. But I fear that whole model is gone because this has become a politically sensitive topic.
And Dr. Wolf, Dr. Jha said, we know how to handle it in saying where we are today in 2022 versus where we were 2 years ago. What's your response to that, particularly with the data? We're going to talk a little bit later about the data that you found from wastewater. But is there sufficient data now that we don't have that constant PCR test data that we did have 2 years ago?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we have a lot more tools than we did 2 years ago to manage the pandemic, right? We can manage COVID a lot differently than we could 2 years ago. And so the risk associated with outbreaks has changed. Of course, that also depends on who you are as an individual, if you're able to be vaccinated, if you're immunocompromised, as Dr. Jha was just talking about. But I also think we need to rethink a little bit our paradigms for tracking infectious disease and anticipating new threats to be nimble and inclusive and not rely on the ways that, you know, individual testing can change over time as it has throughout the pandemic and very much recently with the wide availability of rapid tests, which is wonderful for a lot of reasons, but as we've discussed, can also make it more difficult for us to count individual cases. So fortunately, we do have a lot of those tools.
And Dr. Adalja, getting back to sort of the point you were making earlier, one question I have is about the loss of public trust. Regardless about what Dr. Jha or anybody from the CDC or the White House has been saying, there has been an erosion of trust, both in people who take this virus very seriously and want to do everything they can to mitigate the risk to themselves and others, and also by people who either never thought it was that serious or who just want to move on from it. Long term, what does it mean for our public health agencies to lose that kind of public trust?
To me, this is the most disastrous consequence of the pandemic, that there is now this breach between public health authorities, infectious disease authorities, and the general public. And when we face other infectious disease threats like monkeypox or a bird flu pandemic that may occur sometime in the future, we're going to rely on that expertise to help guide the response. And if people are so turned off by it that they believe it's all politics and it's all integrated into their identity and whether they're of this party or that party or what this politician is saying about this recommendation and people aren't listening to the actual experts, that's going to make everything worse. I did a project on pandemic pathogens a while back before the pandemic, and one of the things I talked about was human factors there. And I couldn't have imagined how much human factors impacted the trajectory of COVID-19 in the United States. And I think for the next pandemic, it's going to be even bigger, that we've now made infectious disease and public health into something that's in the whole political churn, and that's how people view it. And that's going to be the worst for all of us, because that's where the expertise comes from. That's where the solutions come from. That's how people learn how to navigate a world in which there are infectious disease risks.
So, Dr. Wolf, I want to talk about what we know, and I want to talk about the data that you have gleaned from wastewater testing. What does that tell us about, first of all, the prevalence of BA5, how widespread it is, and also the seriousness of BA5?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, we've been running a program, myself and my colleague Allie Baim at Stanford, along with Verily Life Sciences, since November 2020 to monitor wastewater for SARS-CoV-2 and all the new variants that have come up in that time. You know, we take less than a gram of wastewater solids, and we are able to tell something about what's going on with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID infections in the entire community. And so because we've been doing this for so long, and now we're expanding that program across the country, we're able to look at, you know, how closely that relates to cases. And the answer is there's a very, very close relationship between the concentration of the viral RNA that's in the wastewater and the number of cases that are in the community, and kind of develop a lot of, you know, deep research into understanding how those dynamics works. And what we've seen recently is that there's a divergence between what's reported in official case counts and what our wastewater levels are showing us. So what we're seeing in a lot of places across the country right now is that wastewater levels are close to the height, in some cases even above, where they were in January when we had the first wave of Omicron come through. But for the most part, the cases are not showing that. Cases are maybe, depending on the place, more around 20% of what we were seeing during that January peak. And that's because people are doing at-home tests. They're not getting reported. And that's fine, actually, in a lot of ways. I mean, individual testing is always going to be important to diagnose and treat, but to understand what's going on at a population level, having a population-level measurement like this that's anonymous and doesn't require you to go anywhere or stick anything up your nose or know that you feel sick or have access to those resources, and to be able to say, you know, here's kind of where we are relative to where we've been in the past and what the surge is looking like right now is really valuable. That being said, you know, just because we're at a similar level to where we were in January, that doesn't necessarily mean the risks are exactly the same, right? We know that throughout the pandemic, we've seen peaks of different magnitudes, and some of them, like at the very beginning of the pandemic, before we had vaccines, those are much lower. But there were really serious consequences to that in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. So it's a combination of understanding, you know, what are likely to be the number of cases in the community right now and sort of what is the other context that results in risk for people.
Well, I want you to listen to what CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said about how the CDC is still working to learn more about the characteristics of the BA.5 variant.
We do not know yet about the clinical severity of BA.4 and BA.5 in comparison to our other Omicron subvariants, but we do know it to be more transmissible and more immune evading. People with prior infection, even with BA.1 or BA.2, are likely still at risk for BA.4 or BA.5. Several factors will play a role in how BA.4 and 5 will impact the United States, and impact of these subvariants will likely be felt differently around the country. These factors include the level of vaccination and boosting in communities, the amount of prior infection a community experienced, and the level of public health mitigation measures that are in place.
So, Dr. Adalja, even after this, I still have a lot of questions. For example, do you think that the fact that we have not seen severe cases, as severe cases with BA.5, does that mean that the variant itself is milder? Or does that mean that the vaccinations that people who have had, the 67% of Americans who are vaccinated, is preventing serious infection, for example?
It's likely the latter, because you have to realize that BA.5 is facing a population that is heavily vaccinated, with some proportion boosted, and also a lot of people who have infection from prior waves, especially of Omicron, that may not prevent you from getting infected with BA.5, but they prevent severe disease, hospitalization, death. We also have many more people with access to Paxlovid, with access to monoclonal antibodies. So the disease spectrum is shifting to the milder side, and I think it has to do a lot with the tools and the immunity in the population rather than the intrinsic characteristics of this virus. And there is some data that maybe it's better in certain animal models at infecting lower respiratory tract versus upper respiratory tract, but the bottom line is I think that we're seeing decoupling or delinking of cases from hospitalizations. I worked this entire weekend at hospitals in Pittsburgh, both as an infectious disease and critical care doctor. I saw one COVID patient in the hospital, and he was there for something completely unrelated to COVID. That's very different than what I've seen in prior eras of this pandemic, and I think it's a real phenomenon.
And Dr. Wolf, what has the wastewater data told you about the characteristics of BA.5 as compared to other variants?
Yeah, so we track individual mutations in the viral RNA that indicate to us that different variants are present in the community, and that's directly linked to kind of the proportion of people in the community who are infected with that variant. And recently, we've seen a sharp increase in the amount of BA5 in wastewater. Depending on the location, it's somewhere between about 80 to 100% of what we're seeing in the wastewater. And it has been a pretty steep increase compared to, for example, when we started looking at the introduction of BA2. That came on a bit slower. So, I mean, we can see that BA5 has rapidly risen to be most of what we're dealing with right now. And so that's important for us to know as we, you know, see individual people who are becoming infected.
So Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Rochelle Walensky talked about why they are recommending booster shots to more Americans. Walensky said that they have data that the vaccine and boosters prevent severe disease and death. She also says the data says vaccine and previous infection provide more immunity than prior infection alone. Dr. Fauci said this.
The overall principle is that we know immunity wanes with coronaviruses, whether that is natural infection or vaccination. And so if you've been infected or vaccinated and your time comes for a boost, that's when you should go and get the boost. And I might say myself, having been someone who's been vaccinated and infected, when we get the next round of having vaccines available months later, I will be in line to get another boost after that.
So, Dr. Adalja, what do you think? Do you agree with Dr. Fauci when it comes to boosters?
I agree with the general principles that he's elucidated there, but with one caveat. And that's that when you're boosting, you're trying to prevent serious illness, hospitalization, and death. And where we've seen erosion of that protection has really been in high-risk populations. Not everyone, not the 18-year-old kid. That person has very low risk for serious disease to begin with. A booster is not going to appreciably lower their risk. So maybe there's an effect against prevention of infection. That might have been the case during the Delta waves. But in the age of Omicron, what you're getting is a transient benefit from boosting. So I do think it's very, very important. Anybody that's high risk, stay up to date with their vaccines and boosting. We need more boosting going into that population to keep people out of the hospital. But that means that boosters need to be targeted and not a universal recommendations. That might be something that changes with Omicron-specific boosters, but right now I think we want to really hone the message in so that people that really benefit from boosters, elderly, those with high-risk conditions, that they get boosted, that they stay up to date. Other people, I think that's not a good strategy, although public health likes universal messages, and that may be what's happening here. But the data really is strongest in the high-risk population.
Now, Dr. Adalja, that gets to a couple of questions we have from listeners. One from Renee on Facebook asking, is there any data supporting getting a second booster now versus waiting for the more variant-specific vaccine in autumn? Another from Facebook from Terry that says, I am an 82-year-old senior who has had 4 vaccinations against COVID. Should I be able to get a 5th booster now? How should people really negotiate these boosters?
It's all going to depend upon their risk factors for severe disease. So for a healthy person, I think it probably doesn't make sense to continue to transiently boost and get some protection against infection for a couple of weeks. But if you're high risk, like that 82-year-old, you need to be up to date. And that may mean 4th shots, 5th shots. We have to treat people with precision based on their individual risk factors for severe disease. So we will likely see booster recommendations eventually evolve to be based on what risk factors a person has. We've already seen that with the use of Evusheld, the monoclonal antibody for immunocompromised, and we've seen it with second boosters being approved for people above the age of 50. I think that's how you really want to look at it. And it doesn't preclude you. If you're somebody that's high risk right now, you should get boosted today. And if something comes along down the line in the fall, like it looks like an Omicron-specific booster, you get that too. So we really have to target this towards what risks people have for severe disease. And I think we've done too little boosting in people that are at risk for severe disease and maybe too much boosting in people that are at low risk for severe disease because the message has been muddled.
Dr. Wolf, what does the data tell you about long COVID? I know we have a listener from Twitter, Kathy, who has questions about long COVID. Long COVID is a reason, too, why I mask more than the people I see around me. What have we learned about that?
Yeah, me too. Long COVID is definitely top of mind. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we want to look at as we continue to track not just hospitalizations, not just very severe cases of hospitalizations and deaths, but we also want to think about the consequences of long COVID among, you know, many people who are getting infected right now. So our wastewater data doesn't speak directly to the impact of long COVID, but it's one of those ways that we can have an awareness of what the overall cases are in a community, because that is not captured in the hospitalizations and deaths, some of that risk of long COVID. And I know that that is a very top of mind concern for a lot of people. You know, we also have, like, not only people who are at differing levels of risk, but, you know, young children. Vaccines only recently became available for young children. So there are a lot of reasons that these vaccines, which are an incredible tool that we can have these new boosters, and that will, you know, help greatly with the impact of the pandemic. But we also need to consider these other risks that are out there and use tools like masking that are at our disposal to prevent transmission in the first place.
Dr. Adalja, to you, am I too worried about long COVID?
No, I don't necessarily think you're too worried about long COVID. I don't really know what the right level of worry should be about long COVID, because it's still something where there are more questions than answers. We still don't agree on definitions. There is still a need to separate long COVID and from post-ICU syndrome and post-hospital syndrome, which are well-described entities that are not related to COVID, but related to any person that's been hospitalized. So I think we still are just scratching the surface here, but it is the most pressing research question to understand.
All right, we're going to hold there for a moment. We're discussing the BA5 COVID-19 variant and what public health measures are best suited for this stage of the pandemic. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the BA5 COVID-19 variant and appropriate public health measures at this stage of the pandemic. With me is Amos Adalja. He is senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Marlene Wolf, assistant professor at the Gangarosa Department of Environmental Health at Emory University. So, Dr. Wolf, I want to talk now about how we should be thinking about COVID, how we should be thinking about the pandemic at this stage. You know, we were just talking about risk assessment, about things like long COVID. How has your data informed the way you think that the public should be thinking about risk assessment at this stage? Is it mostly monitoring for the levels of hospitalizations and death? Is it overall cases that you're seeing? How should we be thinking about how to handle the pandemic now?
I think that looking at multiple sources of information to form your idea of what risk is going to be right now and our sort of public perception as a whole of what risk is in our community is important. So that's looking at hospitalizations and deaths. That's looking at my individual risk factors. That's looking at, you know, what kind of activities I have to engage in on a day-to-day basis if I'm working from home or if, you know, I am working with a lot of people. But I think also the other thing that we're doing is building a durable infrastructure to monitor disease at a community level so we can look at what is associated with cases of diseases in a community in wastewater. And we're doing that for COVID because this should be part of our durable infrastructure to, you know, not have to be susceptible to changes in testing that happen for, in many cases, good and necessary and positive reasons, but to have that continued data on what are kind of the overall level of cases in the community. And as we know that COVID is here with us to stay, you know, we want to have have a system to be able to track outbreaks, and we also want to be able to track outbreaks of other seasonal threats like influenza and RSV that we're tracking in wastewater, and to be able to pivot and be ready to look for new threats as they enter communities, which is what we're doing now for monkeypox in wastewater. So being able to have a system that is really an infrastructure, we take that same sample. It's, you know, one sample of wastewater solids that can represent up to millions of people in a community, and just do a little bit of a different test on that for the next variant or the, you know, the next pathogen that we're concerned about, to get a sense of those overall levels that we're dealing with. That provides a really important population level perspective on how many cases are likely to be in the community. And then pairing that with the information about hospitalizations, deaths, other risk factors, that can help guide then public policy.
I'm glad you brought up other things beyond COVID, because I am going to circle back to that later to talk a little bit about how what we've learned from COVID can inform those things. But Dr. Amish Adalja, I want to talk a little bit about what you said about a false narrative that has sort of come up in the public, that either it's done, it's over with, or it was never that serious in the beginning, or it's everywhere, it's getting worse, BA5 is very scary. How do you think this false narrative is impacting the way people are thinking about where we are in the pandemic?
It's really instrumental in how people view the pandemic. We've got one proportion of the population that acts as if COVID never occurred, that it was some made-up thing, that it was no worse than influenza. And then you have another who are somehow thinking of this as sort of like a hurricane that is here, and then eventually it's going to go away. And I think neither really reflects the actual biology of this virus, that it was this novel infectious disease that created a major storm in hospitals that killed over a million people, disrupted all of our lives. But it's not something that will lift like a hurricane does, that COVID-19 was always destined to become the fifth seasonal coronavirus, that it was going to become endemic, and our goal was to make it more manageable. And I think we still see these types of this type of narrative animating the way people discuss it. And I think most people don't respect each other's individual risk tolerance, that not everybody's going to acclimatize to COVID-19 in the same way. Some people may be back to their normal life. Other people may be more fearful and wearing masks and doing rapid tests all the time and just being much more careful. And I think that has to be accepted as we move into the next phase of the pandemic. But this false narrative and the way that this has gotten wrapped into identity politics has made it impossible for people to talk to each other on about this and to respect each other's risk acclimatization. So I think this is more, you know, not my specialty, but more something for sociologists and anthropologists to think about, is that there's this total difference in how they're viewing this threat that's really much more different than we've seen with other infectious disease threats like flu or other societal threats that people face.
So Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, gave this final message during his portion of the briefing last week.
The bottom line, it's something that A, we don't panic on, B, we don't let it disrupt our lives, but we take it seriously enough and utilize the tools that we have to mitigate. And the final point is looking forward. We are doing now, and it is critical to do so, to develop the next generation of vaccines and therapeutics, and for that, we do need the support of the Congress in resources for us.
So, Dr. Wolf, I want to talk about what the future looks like, first of all, for data assessment. Like, what should the public be looking to in determining how they should, as Dr. Fauci said, go about their lives? And I also want to talk about resources. Are there enough resources, do you think, for the federal response, for your work, and the work of others?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in that quote just there, you know, panic is an emotion. And I think it is true that we don't want to panic right now. We do have a lot of tools. Now, that doesn't mean we don't take it seriously. We can take something very seriously and do the appropriate response using the tools that we've built over the past 2 years and not panic. And so I do, you know, I think that's wise. At the same time, I think that we have to be appropriately resourced and taking seriously, putting the energy in that we need to use those those resources. So, I mean, the development of vaccines obviously has been an enormous breakthrough that's happened with this pandemic. And so to continue to invest in new vaccines and boosters, you know, that's going to be an enormous, area of research and then health that's going to continue forward because of the pandemic. The wastewater monitoring, also something we had never done, wastewater monitoring for respiratory diseases before COVID. And it's amazing. It works incredibly well. And so this is something that we have to continue to put resources into, to have a national system that is a platform that we can pivot to target all kinds of different diseases and be able to say at a population level, you know, here's what's going on. Here's when something new has been introduced into your community. Here's what the current levels look like. We've put a lot of investment over 2 years into building up the research behind this, into building up the infrastructure behind this. And that is something that we do need the participation of, I think, the federal government to continue to push forward. There is a lot of interest and excitement about this. And, you know, from the CDC, from states, from local communities, people are really appreciative of being able to see, you know, this is what is going on. It's sort of almost like a weather service for infectious disease in my community. Now, again, that has to be combined with other sources of data. But I think it will be really important that we continue to invest in this, particularly as we consider not just COVID outbreaks that continue, but other diseases as well.
Dr. Adelja, I want to talk for a bit about the anti-vaccination movement. What implications do you think that continues to have both for COVID, but also for other vaccines? I mean, are you concerned about flu vaccines and other infectious disease, measles and other things being affected by the anti-vaccination movement?
Definitely. What we've seen is the anti-vaccine movement that's existed in some form basically since the late 1700s really get energized by COVID-19. And it's now not something that was kind of part of the back to nature movement or the anti-pharma movement. Now this is in the mainstream in terms of this used to be something that we thought about on the fringe. Now you run into this on a day-to-day basis. I ran into it just, you know, in my private life all the time. And I think what you're seeing is it metastasized from being just against COVID-19 to flu vaccine rates going down, to measles vaccine rates going down. And you've seen this synergy between people that have been traditional advocates on the anti-vaccine side, people like Andrew Wakefield or Robert Kennedy Jr., now aligning with people on the far right that were usually vaccinated. Remember, Mississippi and West Virginia were two of the highest vaccinated states against other things, but not with COVID. And now you've seen this alliance. And the amount of misinformation that's out there, it's really going to be something that's very, very hard to recover from. And I think we will see childhood immunizations fall. And we just prior to the pandemic had a major measles outbreak related to anti-vaccine groups and populations in parts of New York and New Jersey. I think we're ripe for that to happen again.
Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb was on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday. He said that the federal government's slow pace to get monkeypox vaccines reveals a real problem in how it responds to virus outbreaks.
The White House has intervened to take more control of the response away from CDC. This can't be our response every time, that when CDC drops the ball, the White House and the political leadership need to step in. That's what's happened here. It happened in COVID. We need to fundamentally reform how we respond to these crises.
So, Dr. Adelja, I want to start with you on this. You too have been critical with the White House responses. Dr. Jha said that the CDC is fully involved in this response, but do you agree with Dr. Gottlieb's assessment here?
I definitely agree with Dr. Gottlieb on this. I think that what we've seen with the monkeypox vaccine rollout, the monkeypox testing debacle, all of that is very scary because it happened on the heels of COVID-19, and you're seeing some of these same mistakes be repeated, even though everyone was aware of these mistakes during COVID-19 and how instrumental they were in allowing the virus to get out of control. But there's just no explanation for why this type of thing happens. And I don't know if it's bureaucratic thinking or it's just the inability of our public health agencies to respond to an emergency in the way that they need to. That needs to be reformed. But we can't keep doing this over and over again. We have to be proactive. We have to fix this. And many of us in the field thought COVID-19 was finally the wake-up call that the world in the country and our policymakers and our elected leaders needed to actually take infectious disease threats seriously and develop a system that could be nimble, that could be responsive, that we wouldn't run into these same issues. But The fact that this is happening with monkeypox to me is mind-boggling in one sense, and then also completely expected when you're dealing with the people that you're dealing with, that this type of, that they don't learn from these types of things. So I don't know what the solution is, but we're continuing to be failed by the government when it comes to infectious disease emergencies.
Now, Dr. Wolf, you talked about a lot of what you've learned about data collection and reporting and getting information to the public, but what are some of the drawbacks that you still see existing when it comes to not just COVID, but other emerging things like monkeypox? And, I mean, to be fair, the epidemiology of monkeypox is very different from COVID. So is it fair to say we should have learned from COVID, or is there still a lot to learn about monkeypox?
There's definitely still a lot to learn about monkeypox, so we'll be learning a lot, you know, quickly right now. But something we always think about is when we were doing our initial development of our methods to use wastewater solids for monitoring in like the summer of 2020, we look back at these samples from the beginning of the pandemic in the area in March of 2020, and when we analyzed all of those and looked at it together, we immediately saw, wow, we would have had a much bigger picture of what was going on at a population level if we had been able to test these samples in real time and report that data to public health. So that thought exercise of looking back to, if, wow, if we had been able to use this at the beginning of the pandemic, how powerful that would have been, has been a guiding principle for us in developing the platform going forward and inspired us to begin doing daily monitoring with a 24-hour turnaround in the communities that we've been working in Northern California and reporting that data directly to public health officials and publicly available on our website. And so that's what we're doing for monkeypox now, is putting kind of that moment of, you know, what if we had had this right at the beginning? What if we had been able to test the entire population using samples we're already taking? We're putting that into practice right now with monkeypox. And so we've been doing that since the middle of June in the Bay Area in Northern California. And we have we've been detecting monkeypox viral DNA in wastewater. That data is publicly available. We've been sharing it with public health officials, and it provides this really valuable extra piece of information, even as there's still a lot that we're learning about monkeypox and, you know, how it's shed, how it shows up in wastewater, what that means in terms of the number of cases. There's a lot we're still learning, but it gives us this population level picture that, you know, when compared to the way that individual testing and vaccination resources can be limited, have to be targeted to certain groups, and those sorts of decisions have to be made, you know, we have that population level perspective. And so working mm-hmm. together with public health to bring those two types of data together, I think it's really going to help officials, you know, with their management of the outbreaks.
Just a couple minutes left. I want to give each of you a chance to say, what do you think that the public and the public officials should be focused on in this next stage of the pandemic? First, Dr. Adalja.
The focus really needs to be to transitioning to managing COVID-19 like an endemic respiratory virus. That means having tools like vaccines, boosters, antivirals, rapid tests, monoclonal antibodies at the ready, and also developing newer versions of these that are better and more effective. And at the same time, thinking about expanding to better respiratory virus surveillance overall. I think respiratory viruses have been neglected. Now I think that COVID-19 has really put them on the map, and I think those are where our pandemic threats emanate from. So supporting wastewater surveillance, as you've heard from the other guest, supporting the CDC to be able to do the activities they need to do, all of that's going to be important. But at the bottom, it's about a proactive approach to infectious disease threats, one that's sorely been lacking for decades mm-hmm. and decades. That's what people need to take home.
And Dr. Wolf?
I couldn't agree more. I think that we need to be proactive about building systems that are going to be sustainable, that are going to stick with us, that are going to provide consistent information about COVID and about other respiratory threats as well. And so, I mean, that's wastewater is one great example of something that we can invest in with just one sample per community and be able to tell something about these levels. But that's the goal, is not to say we're taking it less seriously now because we know that it's here and we have to live with it, but to say because it's here and we have to live with it and we do take it seriously, and we know that there are other threats that we need to take seriously, let's make sure that we invest in those consistent and cost-effective systems to help us do that.
Marlene Wolf is an environmental microbiologist, engineer, and epidemiologist. She is assistant professor in the Gangarosa Department of Environmental Health at Emory University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Amish Adalja is senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I am Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point.